What is the future of trade, manufacturing jobs, and automation in the coming Trump era? A closer look and your calls just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through our WJCT app. Just ahead, a look at jobs, automation, and trade in the era of President-elect Donald Trump. What are your thoughts? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, the new head of Head Start, enrolling kids in our area. Also coming up, the new show Eurydice at Players by the Sea. All of that ahead. But first this hour, lots of discussion this week about news that Ford Motor Company says it will cancel its plans to build a plant in Mexico and instead create 700 new jobs in Michigan. Ford President and CEO Mark Fields says one of the factors in the decision included what he calls a pro-business environment he foresees in the U.S. under a Trump administration. The loss of manufacturing jobs has become the economic holy grail of President-elect Trump's incoming administration and has spurred a substantial national debate. Trump on the campaign trail often criticized Ford for its decision to shift production of small cars from the U.S. to Mexico. But there's more to the story than the loss of manufacturing jobs and trying to keep them in this country. The rise of automation, for example, and some economists say a protectionist stance on trade and jobs could have a considerable backlash. Dr. John O'Brien is the CEO of Vista Energy Group. He's also on the public administration faculty at Flagler College and has served on the Florida Energy Commission. He joins us now with a look at jobs, automation, and trade. As Donald Trump prepares to take the oath of office, Dr. O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about news that Ford Motor Company is canceling plans to build a plant in Mexico and instead will keep some jobs stateside? What are your concerns about trade policies or questions under President-elect Trump and the role of automation in phasing out jobs? We're going to have a big discussion about all of this right now. We want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on our Facebook page. So let's begin with the headline. Ford now saying it's not going to build a plant in Mexico. And the CEO first said this was a decision they made independently of Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric, but he's now conceding that it might have played at least some role. When you read that, because you have a letter to the editor that appears in today's Florida Times Union looking at these issues. When you saw that news, what was your initial reaction?
Well, my initial reaction really is that it's a sort of a drop in the bucket, really, of the larger issue which is going on right now, which has to do with trade and jobs. And that is where the focus is. I sort of came across all of this in teaching a course last session at Flagler College, where I was teaching economic policy, and what kind of amazed me was looking at the benefits of free trade that adds about over $1 trillion a year to our economy, that benefits over 300 million people, yet the emphasis was on the 5 or 10 million people that were being disadvantaged and displaced from their jobs. And both candidates turned around and said, well, we just need to sort of eliminate this free trade thing because that's going to be hurting us. In doing the research on it, what I found was that there is something called media-induced emotions, which is studied very strongly in the behavioral psychology area, which says that when people see things like displaced workers or towns that have been abandoned, that they tend to become very gripped by that and in many cases disregard their own personal interests because they want to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really going on here is looking at people who've lost jobs. And so my research then concentrated on what do we do for the people who are displaced? And looking at the research, as you mentioned, for the most part, these people are losing their jobs to automation. Anecdotally, by the way, a traffic light in many languages is called a robot. Why? Because it replaced a person. So as a result, if you really look at the automation, the vast majority of jobs that are being lost in the manufacturing sector are actually being lost to automation. Mm-hmm.
As much as 85%, according to some studies. Although there's a perception that it's our trade policies and the fact that companies won't stand firm to keep jobs in this country. So while that grabs the headlines, you're looking at the longer-term view, Dr. O'Brien, which is what some have termed the rise of the robots, that eventually there aren't going to be enough jobs to go around for most people in this country and really around the world. How great a concern is that for you?
Well, I think it's a great concern. And part of the reason is because we live in a capitalistic economy. So businesses are going to try to drive down their costs to remain competitive against other businesses, both domestically and internationally. So if a labor task can be automated and sent to a robot, and the robot can do that job as well or better than a human being, then they're going to do that. And we can't stop automation. So I think what's happened is politically people are looking at trade because we can stop trade. We can put up tariffs. We can do a lot of different things which could be very destructive to our economy. But we can't stop automation.
You don't think Donald Trump's stance on trade is going to reap benefits for the economy, this more isolationist, protectionist stance?
No, I really don't. I think if you look at what the administration has floated is a 10% tariff on all imported goods. We import about $2.8 trillion worth of goods a year. At least that's what we did in 2015. And if you look at what that would mean, what it's doing is it's taking $280 billion out of the economy, which is the money people would have had to spend if they hadn't paid the extra 10%. And I also don't know where that $280 billion goes.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment. If you're just tuning in, we want your thoughts on jobs, trade, and automation, the rise of robots. When it comes to our future economic outlook, we're also talking about the incoming Trump administration's trade policies. Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, as you've argued, there have been plans put forth to figure out how to ease the blow for people who are going to lose their jobs to automation or trade policies. A professor at Harvard has proposed a system called the Adjustment Assistance Program, which would basically provide a whole series of wraparound benefits for people. These types of programs haven't worked in the past, although he argues that they could work this time because we're looking at a completely different economic future. At the same time, let me ask you about this too, Dr. O'Brien. Countries like Finland, India, even some areas of California are starting pilot projects for what's called UBI, Universal Basic Income. This idea that traditional welfare policies will not be enough for the masses of people who are going to be automated out of a job, and that what societies will have to embrace is a basic stipend for people. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's an idea that needs to be looked at very closely. And I would raise issues like, what are we going to do when 3.5 million truck drivers lose their jobs because trucks can be driven autonomously? There are many other examples of that. And so we can't really not look at things like universal income because those are things that could work. And I really think also that we have to get away from this idea that we're giving things to people they don't deserve. These are people who lost their jobs not because they did something wrong. They lost their jobs because they were automated out of their job.
The truck driver example is one that's come up again and again. One of the only occupations left with a middle class income for someone without higher education. Go on any highway in this country and there are trucks everywhere. As more and more of those jobs become automated, there isn't a plan as yet to retrain those workers to find a comparable income. And when we look at the Ford decision, the CEO of Ford now saying, I'm not going to build this plant in Mexico. I'm actually going to create 700 new jobs in Michigan instead. Do you see that as one example of many we're going to see over the next 4 years of instead of taking the longer view and figuring out how to retrain workers, taking more of these short-term moves to at least try to save a small number of jobs?
I think what we're seeing right now is a reaction to a very powerful president-elect who is pinpointing certain types of situations, for instance, the Carrier furnace plant, that was targeted, and they saved 700 jobs. But right down the street, they're doing nothing. So I think what really needs to be done here is a comprehensive look at what we do about these people who are displaced from their jobs through no fault of their own. What we have done is we've used the Trade Assistance Adjustment Act, which has been a dismal failure because it doesn't go far enough. And it also only addresses displaced trade workers from trade impacts, not people who have been put off by automation.
Let's go to your calls right now for Dr. John O'Brien, CEO of Vista Energy Group and also with Flagler College. What are your top questions and concerns about the future of jobs, automation, and trade? It's 549-2937. Mike is on the west side. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I have an awful lot to say, and I'll try to make it as brief as possible. One thing, Donald Trump, like all politicians, listens to the people. The people say something, he'll listen, and he'll adjust accordingly, too. We've got to stop lying to ourselves. Within the people, the American voters, government does create jobs. Trump needs to understand that he needs to invest in areas like the internet and computers that the government has done in the past where there is no ROI, where there is no reason for a business to invest in that'll create jobs, because it doesn't matter about the economy. You can change money around and call it different things, this, that, and the other. We've got to jobs fight boredom, and more people have to have jobs and something to do to fight boredom. The heck with just the money. Boredom, period. So the government does create jobs, and I hope Trump understands that the difference between running a business and the government is there is no ROI. You don't have to worry about the ROI with government. Go in and invest crazy, and that's my comment. Thank you. Oh, and I drive a truck. All right. Have a good one.
He hung up. He's a truck driver. Okay.
Okay.
So what about that?
Well, I think, first of all, there are jobs out there. There are jobs that are unfilled. If you look even at, for instance, the Indianapolis paper, you'll find that there are lots of jobs that are being advertised that are not bad jobs. The problem is the skill sets are not really compatible with the new jobs. And the current training, the TAA program, which is out there, doesn't do anything except take a person, throw them in front of a computer, say, there you go, now you can use a computer, go on, get out of here and get on with your life. And that just doesn't work. The Professor Lawrence's program does a huge number of things that are well beyond what we've got. And I think it also addresses the comment that Mike just made, which is that we need to stop looking at ROI and start looking at how do we increase the workforce's skill sets.
And there hasn't been political will for that as yet. Now, this program, the Adjustment Assistance Program, which he's proposed and says it would cost $22 billion, would provide wage loss insurance, unemployment insurance, training reorientation, health care coverage, tax-advantaged vehicles like IRAs, tax preferences, lifelong learning. This is, you know, a very long-term sort of support program that he's saying we need to look at for displaced workers. How in the world will there be political will for this kind of expenditure? Do you foresee, as some economists and analysts have predicted, it would have to get to a point of massive crisis for the United States to even consider that type of expenditure?
Well, I think you go back to that media-induced emotion, and you've got a situation where people are displaced, where they don't have income, where they're literally starving in some cases. And I'm not sure how far that has to grow to get there. But the real point is that there is a way to pay for this, and it isn't expensive. But the problem is that if you cut off trade and you cut off that income that people have because of cheaper goods and services, you don't have a way to pay for it. So it's an anomaly. We're looking at policies that are going to make this impossible when it has to be done.
549-2937, Joseph in Fruit Cove. Hey, Joseph, good morning.
Hi there. So I'm a student of history, and I've noticed a lot of trends in the past about job markets closing and new job markets opening up, and I don't really see a job market opening other than highly skilled jobs that require a lot of training and expertise, like as you've been talking about. And I've been reading articles about the $15 minimum wage and protests to get a $15 minimum wage nationwide, and how people in industry think that would just, the only outcome that would have would be people being laid off and companies automating faster. than they would normally. Do you think that would be a good thing, so it would force us to look at the problem now rather than much later down the road?
All right, Joseph. John.
I think that the $15 minimum wage is a different issue in a lot of senses, and that's just basically saying if you're going to work, you deserve to have a living wage, and $7.25, the current federal minimum, doesn't do that. But I do think, Joseph, your point is that there are jobs out there that are not repetitive robotic jobs that are going unfilled. There are a lot of them. And in addition to that, if you really look, for instance, I'd suggest Thomas Friedman's new book, Thank You for Being Late. There is a huge amount of information in there about things that we can do for people that are displaced, train them. And it's not a matter of just putting them in high jobs where they're going to have to know computer codes. This is a matter of assisting in the production of things that are robotized, if you will.
But as yet, none of these efforts have really worked in a widespread way.
They're underfunded. They are not funded well enough. The trade assistance program is one where what you've got is a program which is, first of all, the funding has been cut back year after year after year after year. It is only targeted to companies that have been certified as impacted by a trade event. So as a result, the majority of displaced workers are not even subject to it. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the manufacturing sectors where there has been displaced employment, the use of Social Security disability is 30 times higher than the use of the trade assistance in terms of rehabilitating people or at least making them comfortable, I guess.
And to be clear, under the current Congress, there's certainly not the political will to invest in the type of initiatives that you're talking about.
Well, I'm not sure what to say about the current Congress because we've got the Congress in ways at odds with the president-elect on tariffs, for instance. The Congress doesn't like tariffs. Tariffs would be counterproductive. There's no doubt about that to any economist of any esteem, certainly. But the real point is Congress is going to have to do something about this because the media-induced emotions that are out there right now are real, and they're going to cause people to vote in certain ways.
If you're just tuning in as we speak with Dr. John O'Brien of Flagler College and Vista Energy Group, how concerned are you that a robot might take your job one day? What are your thoughts about the incoming Trump administration's trade policies? The number to join the show, 549-2937, Dave on the South Side. Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I'd like to get the professor's opinion on the linkages between something that the Congress and Donald Trump do agree on, and that's that climate change is a hoax and we shouldn't do anything about it, and the opportunities for job creation by accelerating our transition to a clean energy economy and eliminating subsidies for those projects that are basically not moving towards that goal, and the policy steps like putting a tax on carbon, for example, revenue neutral tax on carbon, and what impacts that could have on job creation here in Florida and the United States, and also this linkage between the fact that we have a port that wants to use public money to dredge a shipping channel to facilitate imports. And the ships are getting bigger because the shipping companies are trying to comply with the greenhouse gas reduction mandate that's legally binding. And yet we have a federal government here in the United States, at least a Republican Congress and president, that don't recognize the legitimacy of reducing greenhouse gas pollution. So all these things are connected. And we need to somehow get the Congress and the president talking, taking a rational approach to this stuff. And I just don't see that happening. And we're like, a blind man trying to describe an elephant here, and where you get 19 different points of view depending on which part of the elephant you're feeling. So if you could kind of pull that together concisely, I'd love to hear what your perspective is.
Thanks, Dave. A little bit off the topic, but what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, renewables are real. They're economic now to a great extent. I think in terms of Florida and in terms of employment, the renewable energy sector actually employs more people than the coal industry does.
It's growing. Absolutely.
In Florida, I mean, we had the amendment, the whole thing that just went down. And the fact is that we're going to have a lot of solar in Florida. I know that from my years as a commissioner on the Florida Energy Commission. But I think the question you're really raising is, are we going to have a recognition of climate change in the Congress? And the answer to that is probably not. And I think that that is problematic. What I would say, though, just to address your point directly, is that major corporations and most people in the country are feeling that that is the case, that climate change is happening, and those corporations are taking measures to deal with it.
Business is leading on it. At the same time, all of the foreign governments that signed on to the Paris Climate Accord have said that they will implore President-elect Trump not to pull out of those accords, although he has pledged to do so. With respect to Dave's point, the caller, that's a topic that we get into quite frequently on this show, and we'll continue to do so. But for right now, let's take a few more of your calls. Hazel in St. Augustine. Hi, Hazel.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a very good discussion because we are realizing that all the dots are connected. And of course, yes, solar energy is growing and providing many more jobs than coal, and now competing with coal and oil in terms of cost. But I just wanted to go back a little bit to the discussion about guaranteeing incomes. And this was first proposed by Milton Friedman, the chief economist for Reagan. And the first experiment on giving people a negative income tax, that's what he called it, a guaranteed monthly fee, was not to do with charity. It was really to do with keeping up demand in our economy, which runs on consumer demand, as we all know. And so the idea was that if you were going to have automation, the consumers have to have purchasing power. And if there are going to be no jobs, it's the best way to deal with this. And Friedman's idea was that you could do away with a lot of the bureaucracies if you just had this one thing of sending people a negative income tax check. So I have a couple of TV programs with a NASA chief scientist on this subject on our TV channel, which is ethicalmarkets.tv. So I just wanted to jump in on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Hazel. And Hazel's been on the program before. I encourage people to look at her website. So going all the way back to Milton Friedman, they didn't call it that during the Reagan years, but in effect, Friedman was proposing what we are now learning about, this idea of universal basic income. The left likes it for a number of reasons, but interestingly as well, many people on the right have embraced this idea, although it certainly has its critics as well. We're going to keep taking your calls at 549-2937. Let's go now to Joe in Jacksonville. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. Am I on here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'd like to toss in a bigger picture perspective here, and that is that we're working with a system that is not sustainable, that system being capitalism. Capitalism requires ever-increasing markets while we're trying to we've got ever-increasing productivity. So you've got more and more goods that we need to produce with fewer and fewer people. There just is not enough work to go around for the people that capitalism requires to sustain. We've also got resource limitations, raw materials, water is one in particular. Energy isn't less so now, but this whole thing is headed for a crash. And the basic problem is, and I know it's unpolitic, but too many people. The Earth cannot sustain the load that we put on her.
That is certainly the fear that many economists have pointed out. Thanks, Joe. And we have a few emails. Let's go to them. Richard emails the show. I am a trucker going back to school for legal assisting. Our country will always need lawyers legal assisting. Whether you agree with that or not, certainly guys like Richard are seeing the future and trying to figure out maybe a different career. What do you think about guys like that who They're worried about their long-term viability in the job market, and they're thinking, well, I'm going to go back to school, learn a new skill, learn a new trade. What about the conservative argument that people are free to do that without the help of the government?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on doing that. I think that that is a very, very good thing and in response to a real problem. But I think that, yeah, sure, people can go back and do that, but there are many ways in order to increase the human capital that we have in our economy right now, which these programs that we're describing here, Lawrence, Dr. Professor Lawrence's program, would increase the number of people who can do that. And I don't know what it is that you have as a base for doing it, maybe savings, maybe you've got other forms of support, but many people don't. So what I would suggest is that what we need to do is mobilize that sentiment so that people like our email friend here can go forward that may not have the resources to do that.
Lots of calls for Dr. John O'Brien of Flagler College as we look at jobs, trade, and automation in the Donald Trump era. James is in Murray Hill. Hi, James. Good morning.
Yes, hello. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Glad to have a job. Go ahead, James.
Yeah. So anyway, my comment is, first of all, and then a question. Trump is basically rolling into office, benefiting from all the hard work Obama has done before him, and no doubt he'll take all the credit for it. First of all, that. And then secondly, my question is, with all the automation, you've gone over that already, so no need to kind of beat that to death. But what specific skills need to be developed to replace the jobs of these people, taxi drivers, manufacturing?
Sure. What will be the most in-demand skills? Yeah.
And then, can there be enough realistic jobs created? So they're my questions.
Yeah, those are the questions for sure.
I think that if you look at – this is a global issue, by the way. Manufacturing has been contracting all over the globe. This is not something that's unique to the United States. And what's happening even in China right now, where the manufacturing base is decreasing and incomes have gone up, now everybody in that position is moving to a service economy. And what is a service economy? A service economy is the lawyers. It is a number of different types of occupations that are out there that are developing. And as automation increases, for instance, you've got LegalZoom, okay, replacing lawyers. Well, the fact of the matter is that LegalZoom has a lot of people working for it. So what we have to do is look inside of these different industries that are service industries that are growing and find those niches that are in it that are developing. And I would also add just briefly, this is never going to end. It's never going to stop. We're never going to have to be able to sit back and say, stop the clock, we're done. The innovation is going to continue, and every time we innovate in this economy, everybody does better.
Do you see the more protectionist stance that President-elect Trump is taking as an attempt to stop the clock?
Yes, I do. I believe that if you're going to look to save $15 and $20 an hour jobs in a manufacturing sector by penalizing the general economy and the income that occurs when people do have the ability to buy cheaper goods and therefore spend that extra money somewhere else creating other jobs, I think that that is a way to try to stop the clock. It doesn't make any sense.
In the short term, certainly, he's going to reap political dividends for this. What are your thoughts about the long view?
Well, I think the long view will change things because the results of Trump's policies are not with us yet. We don't know what they are. And as they become more apparent, the population in the United States, the voters, are going to take a point of view. And we don't have that point of view right now, except maybe on an academic basis like I'm explaining.
Let's go now to Wanda in Riverside. Hi, Wanda.
Hello. I've been very interested in this conversation. And it strikes me that no one's talking actually about taxes and who pays taxes and who doesn't pay taxes. And they call it public funding. Well, basically, that's taxes. And then we give huge corporations huge tax breaks so that they'll save jobs. But basically then, the money they would have paid in taxes they're paying for jobs, but they're still making a lot of money. It just seems like no one's actually talking about the middle class who pays so much taxes. And I don't mind. I get services. But I'm just interested that it's not actually addressed.
Thanks, Wanda.
Well, I think that, you know, public funding is very, very important, but the idea of where is it the money comes from gets lost in that. The idea that we have an income tax, we have a payroll tax. Well, we also have import taxes. We have different types of sources of revenues. And I agree with you. You do get services for many of your local taxes that you pay, your property taxes, your school taxes, and so on. Do you get a lot back for your basic income taxes? And also, if you look at another area, which is payroll tax, well, that money is being taken and spent. The Social Security Trust Fund doesn't have it anymore. And so are you getting that back? And these calls to reform Social Security are just an example of the problem.
And by the way, speaking of where our tax dollars will go in the future, here's an email from Fabrizio in Riverside. The idea of universal income as a solution to job loss is not a solution. It not only goes against the principles of capitalism that America has based its economy on, it will also lead to communist-style economic stagnation. Now, there's a pilot project for this UBI concept in Finland. India this week came out and said they're going to embrace universal basic income. As you pointed out, Dr. O'Brien, there's a pilot project in California. We'll have to see if this model does lead to what he emails. Will it lead to that sort of response or not? We don't know.
Well, I think that it's easy to fall back on the basic dark image of people that they won't work if they're not forced to. I find that many people are motivated, like our friend the trucker who went out and he's trying to become a legal assistant. Nobody's forcing him to do that. He's doing it because he wants to. So I think that there are at least a large proportion of people who will go out and try to improve their lives and try to get training and try to contribute actively to our economy if they're given the chance.
Fascinating to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. John O'Brien on the faculty at Flagler College. He's also the CEO of Vista Energy Group. And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, Siri, Alexa, Cortana, Google Assistant. These days, technology can talk, but who else is listening? The systems feed gigantic amounts of data to computer companies. So much that police in Arkansas want data from an Amazon Echo to help solve a murder. We'll make sense of these smart computers and consider ways to outsmart them. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Every week on our Piano Puzzler, composer Bruce Adolph rewrites a familiar tune in the style of a great composer. One of our listeners calls in, tries to guess the tune, and the composer whose style Bruce is mimicking. Play along with our weekly musical game. It's our Piano Puzzler on the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, with the start of our new year, a fresh start in this area for Head Start, promoting school readiness for underserved children, with a focus on language, literacy, math, science, the arts, physical skills. Duval County Head Start and early Head Start programs serve nearly 2,000 children and families here on the First Coast. Enrollment for local Head Start programs is underway now, with some new centers and more to share. Latanya Winhall, MS, is Executive Director of Lutheran Services Florida. They administer Head Start here in Duval County. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're enrolling now for Head Start, and there's a lot of news to talk about. What's going on?
Yes, well, first of all, Head Start is an early education comprehensive services for children. And here in Duval, we provide services for about 1,800 children, ages 6 weeks to 5 year olds, because we understand the importance of early education, those first 5 years of a child's life. So LSF became the grantee here in Duval County in 2012. Mm-hmm. And
this was after some turbulence, we have to point out, here in Jacksonville over who was going to run the program.
Right. Well, the Office of Head Start selected LSF, Lutheran Services Florida, to be the new grantee. Mm-hmm. And so you are given a 5-year contract to provide services for children. And 90% of the children live below the poverty level.
Right.
And so LSF, our mission is to get these children ready for school and prepare them for life.
Right. And the whole idea of birth to age 5, that period of brain development in children is so crucial.
Correct.
It makes such a difference. Whether they get these services or not. And that's been documented in study after study.
Right.
Now, and Head Start, as I said, was run, I believe, by the Urban League for some time. People are still learning about Lutheran Services Florida here in this area.
Correct. We are new to Jacksonville. And like I said, we are in our fourth year of operation. And so the Head Start program has been around for 51 years. And so it's the same requirements, the same expectations. It's just a different grantee who is now providing the services. And so our Head Start program, we are a full year, full day program. So we operate 12 months a year. But our enrollment continues throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And so we are to maintain our full enrollment. And with that, you know, going into our children will return January the 9th, and we still do have a few vacancies, and especially in fulfilling our 10% disabilities requirement, because of our 1,800 children, 10% of them have to have a diagnosed disability. So we are currently enrolling to fulfill those requirements for that 10% disability.
So you're trying to get the word out about that, and also a new center.
Yeah, well, actually, we have two new centers, and we'll be opening a third new center next week.
Wow.
So, yes, we are very excited. We have our first center out at Jacksonville Beach, and it is the Rhoda Martin Center, and we opened that center in November, and we serve early Head Start and Head Start children there. Last month in December, we opened our second center, which is Phillips Highway, and we are serving almost 100 Head Start children at that location. And then next week, we are excited to open a third center, the New Life Early Learning Center, which will be located on the north side, south of Dunn Avenue.
So the demand is definitely there.
The demand is there. It still amazes me of how many children are entering elementary school, kindergarten, who have had no formal preschool setting. Mm-hmm. And those are the children that we are trying to reach, and those families, to get these children the early brain development that was discussed before the age of 2, and also for the ones preparing to go to kindergarten.
Now, 80% of your students are kindergarten ready when they enter elementary school.
Yes, we are very proud that we have 85% of our children. Those are the child outcomes that we have received from the services that we've been provided, that 85% of them enter kindergarten ready and prepared to learn.
Now, LSF, Lutheran Services Florida, it is one of the largest Head Start grantees in the country.
Yes.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions or criticisms about Head Start?
I think Head Start, because it's a federally funded program, I think that's the original criticism. But again, these are the children, the most vulnerable children, the underserved areas, underserved communities that desperately need. Every child deserves a right to learn. Every child deserves a right to be on an equal playing field where they are able then, again, in preparation for life. And we know that education is the key.
You also involve the parents in Head Start. How do you do that?
Right. Head Start, one of the concepts that I feel separates us from other preschool programs is this comprehensive services. And part of the comprehensive services is beyond the education, we have health, mental health, dental, nutrition, and a parent involvement component. Again, we understand that the parent is the child's first teacher, and we want to encourage these parents from the beginning the importance of being involved in their child's life. So we encourage parents to come into the center to volunteer. We send home take-home activities for them to prepare. We provide monthly parent trainings just to help them grow. We're not only looking at the child's growth, but also the parent's growth. And so we have two parent involvement programs that we are very proud of. And one is called the Amen, and that's to encourage male involvement in our programs. And then we have a Love program, which is to encourage our mothers. And so we just try to do exciting things, training things, again, encouraging them to be an important part of their child's education and growth.
Now, as the new year kicks off, you are kicking off a campaign in Jacksonville, Head Start Heroes. You're really trying to get the word out and increase awareness of what Head Start is doing in Duval County. Tell us about Head Start Heroes.
Okay. One of the misconceptions also is that the program is fully funded, and it is not. The federal government gives us 80% of a contract, and they expect that the community will provide the remaining 20%. And we call that non-federal share and in-kind. And so we are starting a campaign January through March 2017 titled Head Start Heroes. And we are trying to increase our volunteerism, our services, our donations, anything that can enhance the services that we provide. And so we are trying to get the word out to individuals, to civic groups, organizations, companies, anyone, everyone can provide some type of services to our children. We have 39 centers throughout Duval. And so we want to target.
And adding three new ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we want to target businesses around those 39 centers for them to know this is a Head Start location. This is your community. This is how you can contribute and assist our program.
Now, you're new in the position, so this is sort of one of your ways of introducing yourself to Duval. How can people get in touch with you?
Great. Yes. Well, I have been with Lutheran Services Florida Head Start for a year, but I've been in Duval County for 24 years. So I'm excited just to continue the personal commitment that I have to the community. And so, again, we know that Lutheran Services Florida, we need to brand ourselves. We need to get the word out there. We know we need to increase our non-federal share in kind, and that's one of the reasons for our campaign. But we truly just want to inform the community of the good quality services that we are providing. And our child and family outcomes are indicative of the services that we're providing here.
How can people get in touch with you?
Yes, our main number is 423-8637, and that is 904 area code 423-8637. And for the families who are looking to enroll their children, you will call that number to get information for applications. When you submit the application, you will need verification of income, your address, the child's shot record and physical, and an ID. Once your application is submitted, you then will be contacted to see if you are eligible for the program and if we have any vacancies for enrollment. For those who are contacting us to see how they can be a part of our Head Start Heroes campaign, you can still call that main number. And we are just so excited. And like I said, we have centers throughout the city that you can call and say, this is the center that I would like to help, or how can I contribute to this center in my community?
Head Start expanding in Duval County, and she's running it, LaTanya Wynn Hall, Executive Director of Lutheran Services Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
PBS Kids is growing bigger and better than ever because now kids can watch more of their favorite shows anytime you want on the new 24/7 PBS Kids channel, after school or after dinner, even on weekends. Now there's even more PBS Kids to love all day long on the new 24/7 PBS Kids channel, coming January 16th to WJZT Channel 7.5.
The next Jazz Night in America, we're heading to Panama with pianist Danilo Perez.
There is a history here of jazz that is being forgotten. Panama was jazz. Panama was a connection with New Orleans from the early times. It's a hidden treasure.
Music and stories from the 2016 Panama Jazz Festival. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Vince Kong, host of Redux, WJCT's weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. Tune in to catch up on the latest local stories, plus music from our after-hours programming anytime, anywhere. Subscribe to WJCT Redux now on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the new play Eurydice opens Friday at Players by the Sea, a reimagining of the classic myth of Orpheus through the eyes of its heroine. Star Kristen Walsh is here, along with Chris Jackson, spokesperson for Players. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So getting into some classic Greek mythology, Kristen Walsh, tell us about this show. You're the star.
Yes. So the original story is based off of the myth of Orpheus, but takes it in a slightly different direction, follows Eurydice down into the underworld, and focuses more on her relationship with her father as she reconnects with him in the underworld, and her sort of relearning who she is and discovering things about herself and her relationship with Orpheus. And that sort of thing.
Very cool. Chris Jackson, Players by the Sea, known for doing provocative theater. What attracted you guys to this production?
Well, I think one of the things that we stand by is expecting the unexpected. And so when we were looking at Sarah Rule and the way that she writes the productions, we could not go anywhere but to Eurydice because of the language that's used throughout the presentation of the program.
And for people that aren't familiar with the legend of Orpheus or with the character of Eurydice, maybe they haven't been schooled in the Greek classics, which is a lot of people. How accessible would you say this is for the average theater goer, Kristen?
Very accessible. Sarah Rule has written a very modern telling of this, so it definitely contemporizes the tale and makes these essentially archetypes very real people that I think people will be able to connect to.
And as we start off the new year, it's the first weekend of the new year, you guys are coming right out of the gate with a bold new show. Pretty exciting.
Absolutely.
People that don't have something to do this weekend, they should add this to their calendar.
Absolutely. We open up on Friday, and so I think Friday night is going to be an amazing show. They've done an amazing job just kind of telling the story, and to see it come to light each night during the rehearsals, I'm proud. I'm proud to just be able to say, hey, I'm a part, and I'm proud to be a player.
Players by the Sea, its history at the beaches is one that when we talk about all the productions you guys do, I don't think we've really gotten into the history of this theater. It's kind of interesting.
It is. You know, we're celebrating 51 years, you know, we've hopped around to a couple different locations, but the location that we're currently in is an old laundromat. And
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Does it still smell like bleach in there?
When our cleaner cleans with bleach, absolutely. but you know, I think that the theater space alone, you would never know that it was a laundromat. Sometimes I'm like, mm-hmm. Are you sure this was a cleaner? but you know, we're continuously throughout the year adding new things. And I don't know if you had heard, but on the 23rd of January, we're announcing now that we are doing Fences. And so we're constantly
adding classic something. August Wilson.
Yes.
Okay. That's an exciting production, too.
Absolutely.
So that's coming up. But first, it's Eurydice opening Friday at Players by the Sea. Star Kristen Walsh. Any final thoughts to get out to all those theater fans out there?
I think that you'll find something unique about this production. It is poetic and beautiful and hopefully moving. So I hope you guys will definitely come out and check it out.
Come see the new show. For tickets, go to playersbythesea.org and break a leg. Chris Jackson and star Kristen Walsh of Eurydice. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.